And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Produced right here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. I want to suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy, because there might be something you want to write down. Address, a time, a place, maybe a web page you want to refer to, an email address. There's lots of information going to come at you in the next half hour, so be prepared. Have that pencil and paper handy. Let's start off with news from England. We've told you about the badger cull, but 100 strong, the badger army has marched in Gloucester against the cull in this story from BBC, as found on the Earth First Newswire. About 500 people joined the Gloucestershire Against Badger Shooting demonstration in Gloucester City Centre. Pilot culls in Gloucestershire and Somerset were aimed at limiting the spread of bovine tuberculosis. Earlier this month, Environment Secretary Owen Paterson said the pilot culls would continue. Organizer Carol Cook said the number of people who turned out to demonstrate shows it is not acceptable for an industry to be killing our wildlife. She said they were sympathetic towards farmers, but added that the industry needs to look at its own practices and improve biosecurity in the farmlands themselves to stop the spread of bovine tuberculosis. Culls in Gloucester. It isn't us against the farmers at all. Everyone can work together to stop this awful disease, she said. Culls in Gloucestershire and Somerset will continue, but will not be rolled out to the rest of the country. Conservationist Ian Redman said most badgers do not have the disease, and culling is a recipe for disaster, not for curing the disease. And up in Canada, UNISTN camp evicts a Trans-Canada helicopter crew. In this story from UNISTN camp, as found on the Earth First Newswire, on July 22, 2014, the UNISTN camp evicted a Trans-Canada crew working on the coastal GasLink pipeline within their territories in northern British Columbia. If caught trespassing again, Trans-Canada's equipment will be confiscated. I want to see what they're going to do with a helicopter. Anyway, Arizona Forest Service roads have been spiked in this story from ABC 15, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Flagstaff authorities are seeking the public's help to gather any information related to sharpened rebar that was found placed in roads in the Happy Jack area. I guess that's near Flagstaff somewhere. Forest Service law enforcement said that at least 5 pieces of the rebar was placed on forest roads that are frequented by off-highway vehicles. The sharp pieces were responsible for slashing at least 8 tires last weekend, according to authorities. The end of the rebar was flattened and sharpened to a point, and the exposed point has been painted to blend in with the road service. Linda Wadley, Mongolian Rim District Ranger, said. She added that the objects pose a threat to people hiking and walking and to wildlife in the area. And here's an Earth First Journal editor's note. For more information on road spiking, consult EcoDefense, a field guide. On to more news. 1,000 mink have been freed from a Denmark fur farm in this story from Biteback, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Late on July 11th, cages were opened at a fur farm near the town of Ulgod, and as many as 1,000 mink escaped. According to media reports, a large hole was created in the fence surrounding the farm. Slogans such as "Stop the Suffering" were painted on the walls. And unfortunately, the Army Corps has caved in after 3 weeks. The Willits Bypass construction resumes in this story from Save Little Lake Valley, as found on the Earth First Newswire. We knew it would happen at some point. Unfortunately, it came without a serious consideration of downsizing the project. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has agreed to allow Caltrans to resume full construction of the Willits Bypass. The decision came after a series of negotiating sessions between the two agencies that also involved at least 2 powerful elected officials. Congressman Jared Huffman, Democrat from San Rafael, played a key role in making the agreement happen. His office released a statement concerning the bypass. I have personally met with and had multiple phone calls with officials from both agencies, and I am convened an emergency conference call that included the key leaders from both agencies as well as my predecessor and colleague, Representative Thompson, Huffman's statement reads in part. In interaction with Save Our Little Lake Valley members, Congressman Huffman has expressed interest in helping to reduce the environmental harm wrought by the bypass. In the eyes of many SOLLV members, Huffington has now shown his true colors, yellow and black. I added that. The agreement between the Corps and Caltrans involves the Caltrans having made promises to accelerate its implementation of the Wetlands Mitigation Plan, to come up with new wetlands mitigation at some point, and to conduct a study of ways to reduce the amount of fill being placed in the wetlands. These are the latest in a steady stream of empty words emanating from this project. We all know how good Caltrans is at keeping its promises. The Army Corps has yet to sign off on Caltrans's application to haul soil from the old Apache Mill site, the agency's preferred choice among two potential borrow sites for filling in the wetlands of Quail Meadows in North Little Lake Valley, although it seems certain they will start hauling before long. The Army Corps stood behind their suspension of bypass construction for all of 3 weeks, from June 20th to July 10th. And here is the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. America's last wild buffalo are currently enjoying a respite from abuse by government hazers. Family groups, solitary bulls, and bull groups are getting together in bigger herds as the season of the bison rut begins to approach. Yellowstone's Hayden and Lamar Valleys will soon roar with the intense bellowing of massive bulls who make a fantastic display of their awesome power as they challenge each other to determine who will win the right to ask favor from females. A male must prove that he is worthy, for she will not take just any interested bull. As summer flows, most bison calves are starting to turn from their reddish-orange baby color to the chocolatey brown and black that they will don for the rest of their lives. While Yellowstone is not ideal habitat for plains bison, high summer in Yellowstone country is an easy time, a time to enjoy the good life, a time of plenty, and a time of peace, a time for reuniting, and a time to ensure that the buffalo nation will carry on. It is a time when wild buffalo can be buffalo without much threat of human interference or government plans. During these quieter times, the Buffalo Field Campaign focuses on outreach, sharing the stories that we have liked, that we have lived with the buffalo, sharing their current plight and empowering people to take action on their behalf. Summer volunteers are working every day to talk with visitors to Yellowstone National Park, tabling at festivals and farmers markets, and very soon we will announce our West Coast Roadshow schedule. We hope to see you along the way. You can also participate in this important outreach by requesting a stack of our newsletters to help spread the word. And you can get those by going to their webpage, which is buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign wish list, pavilion, and tents are needed. We have updated our wish list on the webpage with a couple of items that will help us in our summer outreach and tabling programs. They need an easy-up pavilion. That's, see those at street fairs and things. They need one of those. They need four-season camping tents, 2- to 4-person tents, and a quiet gas-powered generator. If you are able to help with these wish list items, please contact Mike Meese or Pat and Comfrey, our summer volunteer coordinators. And you can review the Buffalo Fields Campaign's complete wish list on their website. All in-kind and monetary donations are tax-deductible. Where are you going to send your donation? Well, to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, and their zip code is 59758. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. The zip code 59758. If you have any questions, do give them a call. Area code 406-646-0070. Once again, the phone number 406-646-0070. You can find all this information and more at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States, and they need more summer volunteers. So get in touch with the Buffalo Field Campaign. It's a beautiful place, and you'll be glad that you visited or helped out or whatever you're going to do with them, because Mike and the guys and gals are great folks. And wild lynx may once again roam English and Scottish forests in this story from the Gloucestershire Citizen, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Wildcats may soon roam the forest of Dean if a conservationist gets his way. Scientist Jamie Wyver is working on a project that could result in the reintroduction of the lynx to the Gloucestershire district of England. But at this stage, the student at Imperial College in London is exploring attitudes towards bringing back the animal once native to this country. Jamie, who is studying a master's degree in conservation science, said conservation isn't about fencing off areas and keeping people out. It's about working with people. Moving on, when we're discussing wildlife reintroductions, it is vital to talk to those who may be directly affected by the return of certain animals. In this case, I'm keen to hear from farmers, gamekeepers, landowners, and others who live and work in the countryside. His project focuses on the Forest of Dean and the Scottish Highlands, two areas where an introduction may be theoretically possible. Returning animals to their former ranges is now often discussed in connection with rewilding. Bringing back a carnivore can restore a natural food chain and rebalance the ecosystem. However, reintroduction projects involving wildlife that has been absent for hundreds of years require careful planning and considerable consultation with the people who will be living alongside these animals. Paul D. Ornelas, I guess, Jamie's project supervisor at the Zoological Society of London, said, quote, "We proposed this research project initially because lynx are now making a comeback across Europe. The question is, could this happen in the United Kingdom as well?" And Jamie Wyver would like to hear from you, so contact the Zoological Society of London, and I believe that they have a questionnaire for you to fill out there. And Mexico reports its first litter of wolf cubs in the wild in this story from Associated Press, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The first known litter of Mexican gray wolves has been born in the wild as part of a three-year effort to reintroduce the species to a habitat where it disappeared three decades ago, Mexican officials reported today. Mexico's National Commission for Natural Protected Areas said the wolf pups were sighted in June by a team of researchers in the western Sierra Madre Mountains. This first litter represents an important step in the recovery program because these will be the individuals that have never had contact with human beings, as wolves bred in captivity inevitably do, the commission said in a statement. It also said the pups appeared to be doing well. Mexico began reintroducing wolves in 2011, and the parents of this litter had been released in December with hopes they would reproduce. Authorities seldom reveal the exact location of breeding pairs in recovery programs to protect the endangered species. The commission also did not respond to requests about how many wolves now live in the wild in Mexico. And shooting owls to save other owls in this story by Isabel Grock of the National Geographic. At dusk in a forest along Redwood Creek in Northern California, Lowell Diller switches on his digital wildlife caller. The 8-note call of a barred owl breaks the silence. Diller and Riley, his Brittany Spaniel, listen for a response. Almost immediately, the woods are filled with a deafening, cackling duet of a pair of barred owls hooting to defend their territory against what they think is a rival. At this point, Diller, a wildlife biologist, usually ends the duet with a blast from his shotgun. When I went out to do it the first time, I was shaking. I had to steady myself, he remembers. I wasn't sure I could actually do it. It was so wrong to be shooting at a beautiful raptor like this, and it continues to be awkward to this day. As part of an experimental program approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Diller has killed 92 barred owls in the past 5 years on lands owned by Green Diamond, the timber company he works for. He's doing it in the hope of saving a closely related species that's an icon for environmentalists, the northern spotted owl. In 1990, when it was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, the northern spotted owl became the center of a bitter fight between loggers and environmentalists over the protection of its habitat, the old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest. The Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that spotted owl habitat has declined by as much as 88% since the early 1800s, and now barred owls, which are larger and more versatile predators, are invading from the east and forcing spotted owls out. Diller's owl hunting has been the pilot project for a larger effort that the Fish and Wildlife Service began last fall, a 4-year experiment to kill up to 3,600 barred owls in about 2% of spotted owl habitat in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. The experiment will provide us with the information to decide whether this is a reasonable management tool to maintain spotted owl populations, says Robin Bowne, the Fish and Wildlife Service biologist who's leading the project, and if so, what are the difficulties and the costs? Native to the eastern part of North America, barred owls began moving west around the beginning of the 20th century. They arrived in the range of the northern spotted owl in British Columbia in 1959 and have expanded southward since. In many parts of that range, they now outnumber northern spotted owls. There are several theories about why barred owls moved westward. One theory holds that the treeless expanse of the Great Plains once formed a barrier that the owls couldn't cross, but as people settled the plains, planting trees in urban parks and windbreaks and suppressing fires that kept trees from growing, they created stepping stones for the barred owls. The settlers' farms and grain silos also increased the rodent population, providing food for them. According to Diller, the number of barred owls dramatically increased around the year 2000 in Northern California. Before that, they were a novelty, he says. Every time we would hear one, everybody wanted to go and see it because they had never seen a barred owl before. Then, for the first time, we started seeing spotted owl numbers going downhill. When biologist Eric Forsman of the U.S. Forest Service started studying northern spotted owls in the Oregon Coast Ranges more than 40 years ago, he'd never seen or heard a barred owl. One day last month, he returned to an area called Connection Creek, where he'd found his first spotted owl nest in 1972. Walking through thick brush of vine maple, salal, sword, fern, and western dogwood, Forsman leads the way to an old-growth stand dominated by tall Douglas fir, western hemlock, and red cedar. Within minutes, a spotted owl flies in, lands on a tree only a few feet away, and intensely stares at him with dark chocolate eyes. Though they've lost most of their world to logging, spotted owls are unafraid of humans, Forsman says. They evolved in dense forested areas of the Pacific Northwest where humans were uncommon. Barred owl populations from the eastern North America started moving westward around 1900, encroaching on the northern spotted owl's native range by 1959. In study areas within the Pacific Northwest, scientists observe a consistent trend. Barred owls have increasingly been detected in northern spotted owl territories where they are outcompeting spotted owls for resources. And atrazine is still a major frog killer from this story from Save the Frogs. Banned in the European Union since the year 2004, atrazine is the most commonly detected pesticide in America's rainwater, tap water, and groundwater. Produced by Switzerland-based Syngenta, the world's largest pesticide company. Atrazine is a known endocrine disruptor that can turn male frogs into females at concentrations as low as 3 parts per billion. If you live in America, you are drinking and eating atrazine. And if you think your government is working hard to protect you from atrazine, you're sure wrong. 2013 EPA data shows atrazine levels above the legal limits in 25% of U.S. water samples. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently released their 2013 atrazine ecological exposure monitoring program data. The data is extremely alarming. Over 25% of the 938 water samples contained over 3 parts per billion, and the concentrations went as high as 193 parts per billion, over 60 times the legally acceptable limit. These measurements come from water bodies in 5 states: Missouri, Iowa, Texas, Louisiana, and Nebraska. Atrazine has now been shown to satisfy the EPA's requirements for revoking a pesticide's registration. One, it has well-documented harmful effects on a wide variety of organisms. Two, it is regularly found in ecosystems and tap water sources at harmful concentrations. And three, banning atrazine is unlikely to cause major economic problems for the American economy, just as its ban has not caused problems in Europe. The EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment, and the EPA now has the necessary data and thus the obligation to revoke atrazine's registration. Earlier this year, Save the Frogs had a phone meeting with two of the highest officials in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Jim Jones, Assistant Administrator for the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, and Dr. Stephen Bradbury, Director of the Office of Pesticide Programs. I asked them what the EPA is doing about the 80 million pounds of atrazine that gets sprayed on America's soil each year, contaminating our food and water. They informed me that the EPA is expecting to release a draft assessment of atrazine in early 2015. This will go up for public comment, and a final decision regarding atrazine's legality will be made in 2016. Even if the EPA decides to cancel atrazine's registration, it would still be years before it is taken off the market. This means that the EPA's current best-case scenario is to allow hundreds of millions of more pounds of atrazine to be dumped onto American soils. I asked Jim Jones if he has the power to ban atrazine with his signature, to which he replied that he does. Then I asked him if he would please ban atrazine. He said he was not prepared to do that at this time. The U.S. should be the precedent and leader in scientific advancement and ecological protection, not an embarrassment of capitalism-driven destruction. Banning atrazine will be a step in the right direction. The EPA has assessed 75 published scientific papers on the effects of atrazine, but they have disregarded the results of every single study other than a single study. The one study they have deemed worthy of use, Klaus et al. 2009, was funded by Syngenta, the manufacturer of atrazine. The EPA's rationale for doing this was that they created a list of 17 criteria that every study must live up to. If a study did not meet all 17 criteria, its results were thrown out. Thus, the EPA effectively deems all 74 scientific teams to be flawed, as well as all the peer reviewers, the editors, and the journals that publish those studies. Yet the EPA has provided no funding for new research and is not currently conducting its own research. If you want more information about frogs and atrazine, please go to www.savethefrogs.com. That's savethefrogs.com. And exploding shooting targets have been banned from 12 U.S. national forests. In this story by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Daniel Wallace and Sandra Mahler of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Federal land managers have banned exploding targets used by shooting enthusiasts from 12 national forests in 4 western U.S. states, stating the devices could spark wildfires and are a threat to public safety. The prohibition is in Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and western Wyoming, lasts a year, and comes as U.S. land managers reported a rise in the number of blazes ignited by the targets, which emit a bang and a cloud of smoke when struck by a bullet. The devices are blamed for 9 wildfires on federal rangelands in Idaho in 2012, 5 in 2013, said Josh Renz, a range technician with the U.S. Bureau of Land Management in Boise who specializes in wildfires. In May, the devices were banned from millions of acres of public lands in Montana, northern Idaho, North Dakota, and the northwestern corner of South Dakota that comprise U.S. Forest Service's northern region. Also in May, a ban on the targets was put in place running until October, covering peak wildfire season on land managed by the BLM in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Exploding targets contain chemicals that mix to produce a reaction that releases a loud noise and a cloud of smoke or water vapor depending on the brand when hit by a bullet, said Dan Tanner, owner of Tannerite, a manufacturer of the devices in Oregon. Dave Olson, spokesman for the Boise National Forest, said the heat generated can ignite tinder dry grasses, brush, and pines along the area's range and canyon lands. It's been demonstrated that there's a real potential for an exploding target to cause a fire, he said. Tanner said that his targets are safe and non-flammable, but he said that some companies made devices that create dangerous flashes and that some marksmen doctor targets to produce fireballs. The issue at hand has nothing to do with our product, Tanner said. What the Forest Service is doing is akin to banning Bic lighters because someone may misuse them and start fires. Policies on exploding targets vary by state. They are broadly outlawed in Maryland, where an explosive license is needed for purchase and use. Restrictions for exploding targets on public lands have led to a decline in their sales at Doug's Shootin' Sports near Salt Lake City, said sales manager David Larson. Most people don't want to cause any problems out in the woods, he said. And that's all the time we have this week for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 9 p.m. If you want to hear a rebroadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 p.m. That's our rebroadcast time as part of our Environment Friday show list. If you are in Moscow, Idaho area, you can tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, at 90.3 FM. Monday nights at 9:30 to listen to the Earth First Update. Or if you wanted to download or listen to a podcast of this show, please go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. When you get there, search for Earth First Radio News. Don't forget the exclamation point or the Earth First Radio Update. Also want to point out that radio4all.net is a community-sponsored radio archive for broadcasters and independent radio producers. They cannot survive without your donations. Please go to the webpage for radio4all.net and donate if you possibly can. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.